Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the founder and editor of the New Books Network. I've published several academic books, and one of the things I found frustrating is my inability to get them picked up in the press. There really is no PR service specifically oriented toward academic books. Recently, however, I had the opportunity to work with a PR firm in New York, RLM, on a book that I recently published. And I have to say, they did a remarkable job at a very low price. And this got me thinking, I wonder if the New Books Network and RLM could provide a service that would promote academic books. So the folks at RLM and I put our heads together and we came up with a package. It is specifically targeted toward people like you, people who write academic books. So if you're interested, you should go to the NBN website and click publish your book, and there you'll find some information about the services that the NBN and RLM are offering. What we really want to do is provide you with value for money. As far as we know, no such service exists. This is the first of its kind, and we really hope it is successful, and we hope that it helps you get the word out about your academic book.
Welcome to New Books in Political Science. My name is Heath Brown. Today I'll be talking to Daniel Stedman Jones, the author of Masters of the Universe, Hayek, Friedman, and the Birth of Neoliberal Politics. I hope that you enjoy the interview. Daniel, how are you?
Very well, thank you, Heath. I'm very, very pleased to be doing the podcast today.
Yeah, it's a real pleasure. I love the book. The book's gotten a lot of interest, and I've talked to a number of people who either have read it or are interested in reading it, and so it's a fascinating topic, and I think your treatment of it is really interesting.
Thank you.
You write about economics, but you're not an economist, and you write about politics, but you're not a political scientist. So what is your academic background and your other professional experiences that inform your methods and allow you to approach this subject in such a thoughtful way?
It's good that you raised my background and approach, Heath, because in some ways it's fairly distinctive, and I think it did lead me to do the book in the way that I did it in the end. And I suppose my background is originally I left Oxford as an undergraduate and worked in politics and policy in Britain, and for a think tank called Demos, which in the late 90s and early 2000s was very close to the then Labour government. While I was doing that, I got very interested in transatlantic policy exchange. Initially, actually, in relation to Clinton and Blair and Brown, and the links between the New Democrats and the new Labour Party, as Blair renamed the party. And so that kind of got me thinking about transatlantic policy. But I'd done history as an undergraduate, and I have always had a love for history, if you like. And so I wanted, when I left the policy world and I moved to America, actually, to do my master's, initially in the political science department at Penn, working with Roger Smith and others, I wanted to marry politics and history, I think, even then. I suppose in the sort of institutional, American political development, or more historical side, I suppose, of American political science. I was coming at it from that angle. And then, having done my master's in the political science department, I worked with Michael Katz, who was my supervisor, ultimately for my PhD, who again transcends history and politics in a sense. Michael Katz being a sort of, you know, eminent historian of American, the American welfare state, really. And he supervised me in the history department, ultimately, to do this very political project. So it was a sort of an eclectic mix of history, politics, transatlantic thinking and policy influences, if you like, that led me to do the book that I did, ultimately.
Yeah, and I think this varied background really does add to what you've written. Let's talk about the book. You describe three phases of neoliberalism.
That's right.
Why did you choose to write about the second of these, this period between about the 1950s and about the 1980s? What was the reason for that choice?
I chose that period actually because I think it's crucial to what I was most interested in a way, which was how did neoliberal ideas break through politically? There's a lot of discussion, there has been a lot of writing, a huge amount, in both social science, political science, about really the, in a sense, globalization, if you like, of neoliberal thought, particularly as it's come to dominate the development agenda, the famous Washington Consensus that everyone speaks about. But there was very little actually detailed understanding of how initially neoliberal ideas broke through in both Britain and America. Interestingly, I think in America, people assume that free markets are sort of as American as apple pie, as it were. And there isn't an interrogation sometimes. There often is, but there isn't always an interrogation of what brand of free market thinking or free market politics is actually being spoken about. So in the American context, there's that. In British context, there was always a eulogization, in a sense, which we've recently seen a rebirth of with Thatcher's death, of Thatcher and the heroic rise of the new right. And in both of those, I mean, in different ways, if you like, I wanted to challenge those cozy assumptions, and I wanted to look at how neoliberal thought came to dominate the political agendas on both sides of the Atlantic, actually.
You know, and in placing it in this historical context, I think you really do make this point clear about just how radical this time period, particularly the early period, was. And what its reaction was to the sort of the world around it. And so we kind of take for granted, as you suggest, many of these ideas. But these were not new ideas, but certainly different than the sort of the status quo in that time period, which we'll talk a little bit about. As your title indicates, you focus a lot on Hayek and Friedman, but also Popper and others. But I was struck, and you touched on it, that sort of standing off stage through much of the book is Adam Smith.
Yeah.
And you suggest that Smith is very important, but also misunderstood and on occasion misrepresented. So what is the role that Smith plays in the development of this neoliberalism during the second phase? How important is he to these figures like Hayek and Friedman and others?
I think Smith brings a legitimacy that is somewhat unwarranted, but is claimed very clearly by neoliberals. They want to claim both neoliberals of especially let's talk about the Chicago school, you know, Milton Friedman, George Stigler, and then ultimately also the politicians, so Margaret Thatcher and Ronald Reagan most famously, but other politicians within their governments and their influences. Both the economists of the Chicago School and the politicians, they want to claim Adam Smith. It lends a legitimacy, it lends a sense of continuity, if you like, between their ideas and a sort of classical heritage, if you like, going back to the 18th century. Now, of course, I don't mean to say that there are no similarities between some of what Smith said and certainly some of what Smith was describing in his economic history and in the Wealth of Nations, and what the subsequent neoliberal thinkers of the Chicago School thought. But what I want to really analyze in the book or look at in terms of Smith was the fact that actually there is a willful misunderstanding of what Smith means when he speaks of the free market and the invisible hand. And actually, the absence often in neoliberal interpretations or readings of Smith of the crucial other dimension to Smith's thought, which is the idea of cultivated moral sympathy. So that self-interested individuals do not simply pursue through their selfishness ends that create social or collective goods in the way that neoliberals want us to believe. In fact, self-interest in the Smithian sense is a much, much more nuanced concept. And it's a concept that doesn't equate very easily to some of the policy outcomes that we see in the 80s that, if we're being crude about it, the sort of greed is good culture. which was celebrated by neoliberal politicians, certainly.
Yeah, and this often happens as we move from the intellectual debate to other kinds of debate. The details are lost and sure. become and that's much of what you write about. These intellectuals come together, but they do more than just write about freedom and markets. They also begin to build institutions, and many of those institutions are transatlantic in nature. One of those institutions is the Mont Pelerin Society. Which people sort of always hear about, but I think many people think of as sort of a secret society that existed in the shadows.
Yes.
That's probably not the way it actually exists, but it sure does feel that way when it's sometimes talked about. So tell us about the Mont Pelerin Society. What is it? How did it function? How important was it during that time period you studied, and is it still around with us today?
You're right to bring up the Mont Pelerin Society because it's a very important bridge, I think, between the early neoliberalism that I describe in the book, which, if you like, could be thought of as the first phase, which I don't spend a huge amount of time on, but I do discuss at the beginning of the book, and the second phase, which I think is characterized by a sort of more active American contingent, if you like, of neoliberals. Hayek found the Mont Pelerin Society in 1947 on the back of his attempts to really challenge what he saw as the dominant collectivist agenda, which had been shaped, as he saw it, by more liberal or in the European sense, left-wing think tanks. So in Britain, that was famously the Fabian Society, and also the origins of the LSE, really, being an institution that was built by the Fabians and by the Webbs. And then in the American context, the Brookings Institution would be a good example, which I think was founded in 1916 or thereabouts. So, but Hayek is especially focused on the success of the Fabian Society, and he sees the progressive policy world, as it were, and their success in shaping mainstream politics, leading through the early 20th century, again in the British context, the new liberalism of Lloyd George and Herbert Henry Asquith, but of course in the American context, most famously the New Deal, building on the sort of reforms of the progressive era, and the sort of new forms of radical activist liberalism, we might think. And what Hayek's trying to do, obviously, is refocus, as he saw it, back on the classical or individual, the focus on individual liberty of classical liberalism. In order to do this, he sees the Mont Pelerin Society as a crucial way of linking up liberal or neoliberal thinkers in the various pockets in which he saw them as being isolated across Europe and in America. And in 1947, among the first attendants at the conference in Mont Pelerin in Switzerland were Milton Friedman, George Stigler, and James Buchanan, who would all become the leaders of the Chicago School and the Virginia School in the post-war period in America. And so I think that's a sort of very important hinge point in the development of neoliberalism, away from the concerns of Hayek, which were primarily based on Britain and the Depression in the 1930s, and the Second World War, which was primarily in the context of the neoliberals, a European war, because they were reacting against the totalitarianism of both left and right, Stalinism, fascism. And then moving into the sort of post-war period, where I think neoliberalism is really developed by Americans primarily in Chicago and Virginia, who are characterized by very different concerns of rising prosperity on the one hand, but also the Cold War context of fighting communism and really seeking to define American capitalism in opposition to that.
In terms of just actually functioning, was the society arranged to hold convenings, or was it a source of publishing? What was the manner of transmission of ideas during that time period? lacking some of the methods that we have today?
There would be regular meetings, and papers would be given at those meetings, and they, in that sense, ideas would be exchanged in quite a closed environment, actually, initially. But the idea was that those ideas would then be transmitted through different think tanks, really, that spread outwards from the core of the Montpelerin Society. So you get in America, obviously, the American Enterprise Institute, the Foundation for Economic Education, both of which were founded in the 40s, which actually, in the American Enterprise Institute, well, in both cases, they precede the foundation of the Montpelerin Society, but both become very important as propounders of some of the ideas that emerge from the discussions, if you like, between the different thinkers, European and American thinkers primarily in that period. And a similar thing happens in Britain with the Institute of Economic Affairs, which is founded in the mid-50s. And these organizations consciously popularized the ideas in a sense that the high elite intellectuals of the Montpelerin Society generate and discuss between themselves. And the other thing about the Montpelerin Society, which I think is very important and presages the one of the most important themes, if you like, to neoliberal thinking, is its cosmopolitan nature. So although what I'm describing in terms of the shift in the locus of activity from Europe to America is definitely a feature, it is still also the case that neoliberal thinkers are a cosmopolitan bunch, and they're both, you know, they're from Europe and eventually from other places like Japan and America too. So it's a real exchange, and Australia and so on. So there's a real exchange, an international exchange of like-minded elite economists, historians, journalists, writers, liberal activists of one sort or another.
Part of the story you tell is not linear in nature.
No.
Friedman, for one, is rejected in his initial efforts to influence policy, and there were conflicts in trying to sort of move his agenda forward.
That's right.
So, what was the initial skepticism to Friedman and neoliberalism, both in the U.S. and the U.K. And how did they ultimately break through and have this major footprint on the Thatcher and Reagan administrations?
If you go back to the earlier thought about Adam Smith and the imperfect application of his ideas, I think this is a key feature, if you like, of the transition from the academy to politics and policy, is the distortion, mutation of ideas as that process happens. And I think what you, I start the book with a quote from Keynes talking about the importance of ideas of long forgotten academic scribblers being taken up sort of 30 years later by policymakers. And I think in the 50s and 60s in both America and Britain, crudely speaking, policymakers were in the grip of Keynesian or neo-Keynesian economic techniques of demand management and fiscal fine-tuning, really, which seemed to be delivering results. What Friedman himself admitted is that he was banging his head against a brick wall for much of that period, and certainly in the 60s, when he was becoming prominent, without people listening, because it's when the facts on the ground change that people really start to turn to alternatives. And one of the key, important facts, if you like, about the neoliberal agenda was that people like Friedman and Stigler had ready-made ideas that when the time came that the existing policy techniques seemed to be failing, policymakers could turn and say, ah, here we have, you know, a critique of economic regulation from Stigler, so we can pursue a policy of deregulation, which was initially pursued by Carter, or indeed in terms of monetarism. Friedman seemed to have a solution to the problem of stagflation. The money supply was controlling the money supply was key to controlling inflation. It seemed to be a simple proposition that was workable and that was immediately usable. And I think that those, it was once you get the break, you get the emergence of stagflation, the breakdown of the international monetary system and the collapse of Bretton Woods, when these things, and the oil crisis, when these three multiple crises, if you like, happen in the 70s, that is the moment at which neoliberal ideas are taken up.
So neoliberalism, as you note in the book, is in a third phase of sorts today, maybe even into a fourth. But you suggest the term, you know, is so often misused today. Is there still value in using the term? You know, has the meaning of this term neoliberalism been so detached from its intellectual history that it causes more confusion than clarity in either intellectual debates or policy debates? What is the value of this in today's context?
That's an interesting question, because with my pure historian's head on, I think the term neoliberal is so far removed from its original meaning that it may be useless now to use it. So, for example, the original neoliberals in the 30s and 40s thought of themselves as trying to find a middle way between the laissez-faire economics of the 19th century and the night watchman state of the Manchester School in Britain, particularly, which they saw as being too sparse and not interventionist enough in certain key respects, on the one hand, and then on the other hand, the totalitarianism that was being witnessed in Europe, but also the threat of totalitarianism that the early neoliberals saw in the policies of Roosevelt and the New Deal, and those kinds of activist, corporatist policies. So they really did want to refocus on individual liberty from that sort of totally different perspective, if you like, to the perspective of the last 30 years, where neoliberalism is simply a byword almost for globalization. However, to the extent that neoliberalism now refers to limited government, deregulation, low taxes, it's probably worth keeping as a shorthand for the dominant policies of the last 30 years. So with my pragmatic political head on, if you like, I think neoliberalism is a good term to use for the dominant policy paradigm, really, of the Anglo-American or the Anglo-Saxon economic models of the last 30 years. And that model, whether it's under threat or whether it's changing or whether it is proving its tenacity and continuing to dominate, is yet to be made clear. I mean, the crash of 2008 was obviously a moment at which this could have come apart, but both Obama and certainly the politicians in Britain here at the moment, in many ways have continued with that paradigm rather than challenged it in fundamental ways. So it's a useful term, I think, to hold on to, because I think it really has dominated the politics on both sides, the economic and social policies on both sides of the Atlantic since Reagan and Thatcher were elected, and probably a few years before as well.
I got a ton out of the book, and I'm very curious about what's next for you. You're not in a traditional academic setting now, so is there more in the way of your scholarship to come, or have you put that on hold in any way? What's in front of you right now?
No, I very much, I think you're referring to the fact that I'm now a barrister, which is essentially a trial lawyer in Britain, and I work mainly on environmental and planning cases over here. But I very much hope, I was in America and the States recently doing various things in relation to the book, I very much hope to continue writing history and politics as far as I can. And my immediate next task is to think about my next book, which would be something looking a bit more, I suppose, at what the sources of a regeneration of liberal democratic, or in European terms, social democratic politics might be, and whether it's possible, in fact, given my own trajectory, having studied in America and lived in Britain and grown up there, whether it's possible to marry European and American traditions of progressive thought, and so it would be a sort of, again, a marriage of politics and history, to sort of focus, I guess, on the other side of the political spectrum.
Well, you'll have to promise to come back when that book is finished. The current book, Masters of the Universe, Hayek, Friedman, and the Birth of Neoliberal Politics, is published by Princeton University Press, available at their website and Amazon, I'm sure. Daniel, thank you very much for your time today.
Thank you, Heath. It's been a pleasure.